Dr. Soder's office again regarding that root canal? The doctor's in his office, waiting. He's beginning to dislike you.
Welcome to 200 a Day, the podcast where we talk about the 70s television detective show, The Rockford Files. I'm Nathan Paletta.
And I'm Epidiah Ramshaw.
While Epi desperately tries to pull up his notes.
I got him.
At some point, we'll stop stumbling over the how did we pick this episode,
right?
As we continue saying that we've already picked them. But yes, we're on to our next episode of our final appreciation cycle here of the Rockford Files, where we are talking about season 3, episode 10, Piecework.
Mm-hmm.
This one is in the order because it is not the final, but it is the next to final, the penultimate. Episode directed by Lawrence Doheny.
Oh, great.
Who is one of the more prolific directors. I think clocking in right under, I think, did Ivan Dixon did 13, is that right? Or 12?
I don't know off the top of my head, but quite a bit.
Yeah, it's around there. He directed 12 episodes. We've done most of them already, except for this one and the next one. So we will talk about him a little bit more, I think, in our next recording.
Tune in, Lawrence Doheny.
Doheny? I think so. Doheny?
Lawrence Doheny fans, stay tuned.
Stay tuned. Yeah, season 3 episode. He did all of his stuff is in the first 3 seasons.
Oh, okay.
So if we're going to talk about Rockford vibes,
mm-hmm.
certainly a early series vibe.
Yeah. Although this one gets a little on the... I don't want to say wacky. It's not wacky. It's got good humor in it. It's got really, I mean, they all do.
So this one is a Juanita Bartlett script. Mm-hmm. At this point, David Chase is on the staff, has been writing and is producing. And I feel like this has a Chasean edge to it.
Chasean edge.
The shadow of Chase lies long over this particular episode. I think other than that, not. This is a bit of a meaty middle episode. I don't really have anything in particular that I found or to say about any other background stuff. We got our core cast. We got Bartlett writing. We got an experienced director at the helm. And we have a really fun guest star. I will say that.
Yes.
So, yeah, I don't know. Do you have anything before we get into it?
No, I go into the opening montage. We're so good at this.
It's just smooth,
like gravel under a Firebird's tire that's spinning out. Yeah, opening montage. 3 things that stood out to me. Number one, it's just the great Rocky moment. We're not going to get a lot of Rocky in this episode, but just the Jim's like, I'm looking for Lee. No, you ain't. You're looking for what you're always looking for, trouble, right? Like this good Rocky Jim dynamic. Good Jim Dennis dynamic with the next
bit. There's some good Jim Dennis in this one.
Yeah.
And this is a entry in the light continuity of Dennis's progression through the ranks at the police department.
But just the, you told me a lot of things. and then, car chase. And this is not just a tease. We're going to get a car chase. We're going to get like a legit showdown. Vehicular showdown. Looking at IMDb, since we are neither one of us car guys, it sounds like there's a lot of, car shenanigans that happen in this episode where like one car is swapped for another car from one scene to the next. And I'm embarrassed to say I didn't catch any of them. Mm-hmm. So I'm looking at other things, right? I'm just paying attention to other things. That's right. All.
Yeah.
Ooh, I'm paying attention to the soundtrack. The soundtrack on this
soundtrack is real good.
Right home about this one. This is fun.
It has a lot of good stuff in the soundtrack. I noticed that as well. Yep. I think there's the element of danger from the preview montage. Put the deal off or put him off.
Yeah.
You know, there's something going down there, but yeah, pretty brief. And I was like, oh, okay. I guess we'll get into it. 200 a Day is a 100% listener supported show. Thanks to our patrons. In addition to our gratitude and editing access to the 200 files spreadsheet, patrons receive exclusive episode previews every month and plus expenses, our bonus podcast where we talk about media, work, and our lives. In addition, Every episode, we say thank you to our Gumshoe patrons. Brian Burnson has a Facebook page where he drives his Rockford tribute car to shooting locations from the show. Facebook.com/BrianRockfordFiles. Chuck Soufel's one-shot comic, Sherlock Holmes and the Wonderland Conundrum, is available at whatyoureadingpress.com. Find Dale Norwood's book, Trading Freedom, How Trade with China Defined Early America, wherever good books are sold. It's about fast ships, cheap drugs, and American political economy, published by the University of Chicago Press. Join Mitch Hampton to examine all matters aesthetic and what it means to be human at the Journey of an Aesthete podcast, wherever you get your podcasts. Paul Townend also recommends the podcast Fruit Loops, Serial Killers of Color, at fruitloopspod.com. Shane Liebling has all of your online dice rolling needs covered at his website, rollforyour.party. And check out Jay Adon's amazing miniature painting skills over at jayadon.com. Thank you to Andre Apignani, Tom Clancy, Pumpkin Jampa Peach Pug, Dave P., Dave Otterson, Kip Hawley, Dale Church, Colleen Kelly, David Nixon, Nathan Black, Robert Lindsay, and Jay Thompson. And finally, special appreciation for our Detective Little patrons, Joe Greathead, Michael Zalisco, Eric Antenor, Brian Pereira, Jordan Bockelman, not Brockelman, Bill Anderson, and of course, Richard Haddam. If you're interested in keeping us going for as little as $1 an episode, check out patreon.com/200a day to see if becoming a patron is right for you. We start this episode off seeing our guest star. This character's name is Murray, and he is played by Michael Lerner. As I note here, star of small and large screen. He's just a really recognized, like, as soon as I saw him, I was like, oh, this episode, because yeah. I'd seen this before, and I'm like, oh, it's the one with this guy in it. He's very,
he's good. He's
distinctive.
Yeah.
But I mean, he's, you know, he's in a bunch of TV around this time, but he,
yeah, I'm thinking through this, trying to find like the iconic role that I can see him in my head. He's been in a little over 10,000 things.
Yeah, he has a lot of credits, but he has a career that goes from TV to movies. But I guess some of his known roles are, he was in Barton Fink. He was in Newsies. This is one that jumped out to me. He was in Maniac Cop 2. I imagine you've probably seen that.
He was in Profit and Loss.
Yes, and this is his
fourth appearance.
His fourth and final appearance in the Rockford Files. He was also in the pilot, so we are not going to be finishing his series off either. But yeah, he was an elf. Like, he's, you know, he's a face that isn't just a that guy. He's also a, like, he's not just a that guy. He's a, that guy, if you will.
He's a fun character in this one, with some twists and turns, actually.
Yeah. But yeah, he was in Profit and Loss, and yeah, I don't quite remember exactly what character he was in that, so maybe not super distinctive, but...
it's been a while.
It's been a while. Anyhow, we start off seeing him in a green sweatsuit at a gym.
A 70s gym. I think it's very important.
There's a lot of wooden elements of workout machines.
Yeah, like big chunky.
This whole first sequence does a lot of ominous foreshadowing without having a lot of dialogue. Yeah, we see this character. We'll eventually learn that his name is Murray. I say that he looks like a Murray, but he's working out. And then as he leaves the main gym room, we see two other guys kind of detach from the activities that they're doing and follow him. So there's a little bit of a,
suspect.
Suspect. Yes. That is specifically so that we see it happening. Mm-hmm. And then we transition from that to the camera finding Jim, who is
speaking of 70s Jim,
blue 70s sweatsuit.
So good.
It is extremely good. And I will reinforce that with one of my screenshots. He kind of wanders around, ends up at the pool, has a moment where he trips over a rip in the canvas on the like diving board or whatever.
Yeah.
You got the picture?
Yeah, it's a good picture. Can I just say I can smell this pool?
Mm-hmm. the chlorine is strong.
Yeah.
But there's a swimmer who comes over to talk to him after that, pointing out the irony of coming here for your health, and then the place almost kills you. And you know, he's the second guy who almost ate it. A few weeks back, a guy named Tom Varney took a header over the balcony into the drain pool. Well, it's a little unclear here. We learn that he was paralyzed from this.
Yeah.
He points out a guy on the other side of the pool, Tony, with the Palm Spring tan. He's the one who actually saw it happen. And then we see a guy come out of a door and summon Tony to come inside. And then Jim kind of fades his way over. So Jim's doing his like, oh, hey, you hear about this? Like, he's clearly looking for information about something. He's not just, you know, working out for fun. We cut from there to the locker room where our buddy Murray is getting dressed. And we get his first character trait, which is that he is a flashy dresser.
Yes. This is fun character business. We've already been told via the camera work and whatnot that he's an important character.
Yeah.
But this bit is just, I don't know. I just really, where he goes on and on about how he can spot cops.
Right.
And it's going to influence the plot, but I think it's also like, it's doing that double duty of like doing that and also showing out he's he's a fancy dresser. Like, he's got this very superficial understanding of the world.
He has a worldview that is very, like, specific. And the specificity is what people wear. He's talking to these two guys. They will also be important. They're goons. They're vaguely goon-coded. And then I think very soon we're like, oh, no, they're goons. But Angie and Frank, the conversation is around Angie's like, hey, I wanted to see the guy who does your tailoring, but he doesn't take new clients. And Murray's like, I'll talk to him. When do you want to see him? Tuesday? You got it. Like, he's a very, you know, kind of like operator kind of guy. Then they're talking about threads.
Threads talk. Take cops, for instance. You know that old gag about the flat feet, huh? That ain't what gives them away.
It's the clothes, huh?
No, they got no accessories to go with it. Crummy watch, class ring, that's it. 10 will get you 20. They're wearing brown shoes. Color coordination, never heard from it. Shirts, plain, drip dry, white, maybe blue if they're feeling really jazzy, you know? Pants, 2-for-1 off the rack. I never seen one of them wasn't wearing a jacket. Cost $27.50 tops.
Well, we hear the whole conversation as we go from seeing them to seeing Jim putting on his clothes kind of in the background. I think it's a little unclear whether Jim can hear them.
I don't know if that's the case either, but they're definitely describing him.
Right. Yeah. So Murray is saying each thing that he's doing, basically.
Yeah.
Jim finishes getting dressed, comes over to the guys and asks. And I think he did not hear them. I don't think there's any indication that he was like listening to that conversation, because he comes over with his kind of like, oh, hey, did you hear about what happened at the pool the other day? Isn't that a crazy thing? Like,
yeah.
Seeing if anyone is going to either talk to him or give him or react to his fishing, and they just look at him like none of them say anything.
It's got a very hello fellow kids vibe.
It really does. It's not Jim's best work.
No, it isn't. No.
But I do have a contrasting picture here.
Oh yeah. Yeah. The way Murray is dressed is great.
Mm-hmm.
And it's good that he's got these goons that are not as well dressed as him.
He tells, and this comes up later, he tells the guy Frank not to put all of his bottles in his pockets. It breaks the line. So he has all these pill bottles, and this will become important later. But it breaks the line. You don't want your pockets bulging. This is the big tie era. So Murray's his flashy dressing always has a big tie. And we do end the scene on Jim telling Murray, that's a nice looking suit.
Yeah.
We stick with Murray as we go to what turns out to be like a water amphitheater.
Like a SeaWorld kind of thing.
A water show kind of thing. Murray is talking to two guys in some bleachers where they're alone, saying that he saw a cop at the club. He could tell right from the clothes, and they should check it out. These two guys are clearly fed-coded, right?
Yeah.
Like, I'm watching this, I'm like, okay, these guys are feds. I don't know how they do it, but they managed to cast goons that look like goons and feds that look like feds.
Yeah. And to the point where I had mixed up. So one of them is played by Jack Bannon, who, if you've spent any time watching the Lou Grant Show, mm-hmm. which you probably should, is the other guy on the news desk, like Lou Grant's second in command, I guess, or whatever. Let's say that. Fun character. The opposite of Lou Grant, often very, very well dressed. And so I thought, oh, this must be one of the goons that, like, because I associate this actor with being well dressed.
Oh.
And then got a little confused, but I got cleared up later on. I don't need to confuse our audience with that. Jack Bannon's a great actor. He has kind of a fun role here as this hapless Fed, one of the two mm-hmm. hapless Feds that we have. The change of scenery was a thing that like confused me at first when I was watching, because it didn't sink in that they're meeting somewhere that they won't be overheard, and it's in public, so they could just be sitting next to each other. Like, it's a very like clandestine meeting, I mm-hmm. guess. Clandestine feels like it happens in the dark, though. I don't know. But anyways, the point is, because I was like, why this water park? Like, what's happening here? And then, like, oh, he just has to be somewhere. He can't walk into the federal building.
Right.
Like, yeah.
Murray is getting a bad feeling, but they say they'll take care of it. He always gets nervous before a bye. the joke here, then, is that we see it's a dolphin show, and a dolphin is leaping through a flaming hoop.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a Murray character line.
I got no respect for anything goes through that kind of shtick for a lousy mackerel.
This is the beginning of the Murray double standards.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. And after he leaves, one of the Feds says he'll deliver. He always does. From here, we get our credits over some footage of Jim driving the Firebird. Mm-hmm. As we quickly learn to his current employer at the Talmadge Insurance Company.
Now, this is probably the first of maybe two or three times I'm going to just point out that the variation on the theme over these credits is amazing.
Here he is submitting, it's not a report, it's an expense account. We have a classic Jim versus the guy who doesn't want to pay Jim for the thing he's paying Jim for.
Yeah.
Situation here where Jim is making progress. He's found an eyewitness to Tom Barney's accident. This insurance guy, they are on the hook for covering Tom Barney's, I guess, medical expenses
mm-hmm.
From this accident. So they've hired Jim to look into it, basically to see if they can get out of doing that. he gives Jim some pushback about stringing out the job to bleed the company. It's always the same with day workers. And he mentions a couple times how much he spent on the health club membership to get Jim in there to do his job. He says that this case could cost the company a fortune. And Jim, in which case, you'll raise your premiums. Do you want to cheap shot the insurance business, or do you want the job? And Jim with a great, I think I'll cheap shot the insurance business.
It's so good.
It's the greatest power play. We all love to see it when Jim's just like, I don't need this job. I mean, he does need the job, right?
Yeah,
but he, like, it's not worth it to deal mm-hmm. with you. So he's willing to walk. And the insurance guy, of course, is incensed that he would dare walk out on him. But Jim does it his way or doesn't do it at all.
Mm-hmm.
And so he has him sit back down and he picks up the expense report.
That's how you negotiate.
Well, that's the thing. If you have to be willing to walk, that's what gives you the mm-hmm. power, right? I do like how at this point we're like, oh, this is like an expensive, nice health club.
Yes.
And I guess just the image of the fancy private health club has really changed since
yes.
1976.
I mean, the last rowing machine I saw didn't have, you know, teak oars.
Well, yeah, but wait, you don't think all the machines all jammed together and the yeah. men in sweatsuits going between them is not a great image?
Mm-hmm.
But yes, we get an establishing shot of the Brent Air Health Club, and our two goons are coordinating something with Murray. Like, so they're in the club again. Mm-hmm. He's in a sweatsuit. they're clearly planning. They want something to happen. Murray's going to delay Jim in some regard and goes over to talk to Jim, who's working out on the, like, a leg press or something, and starts making small talk, just like also trying to find out, you know, what his deal is. We have a nice cut where it's like, you know, he introduces himself and says, "And you are," and then we cut to one of the goons looking at one of Jim's fake business cards with his cover name on it. He also has a driver's license with the same name. So we see he's done his, like, deep cover version where he's lined up all his IDs and stuff for just such an occasion. But even though they agree, that doesn't mean anything. You can get all the ID you need in the street in 10 minutes.
I was thinking about this in particular because this there's a trope in this genre of show where somebody is, like, one step ahead of the criminals in all cases or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I was like, why would Jim expect them to dig through his locker? Mm. But then I remembered, he's got to get a membership at the gym, and he is investigating the gym. So he needs that deep of a cover just to get in the door.
And we actually get that reinforced in the next scene where they mention that it's the same name as what he registered as or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. So, but it did take me a moment. I was like, this seems a little contrived, but it actually fits very naturally.
Jim's cover is that he's in the telecom business, but it's more of a more sophisticated equipment than your general consumer stuff. It's mostly recording and monitoring equipment that he sells to the government, not a government contracts. He says he's looking to talk to this guy. Tony asks if Murray has seen him around. So we go to the desk of Ciro Lucas, who is the owner of the club. So he's talking to his goon. They reiterate that his ID matches his card and it matches the register, but that doesn't mean anything. Have we checked his car through the DMV?
Very thorough.
Murray comes in and says that Jameson is the cover name. Jameson doesn't smell right to him. He doesn't dress like someone who works with the government. And he asks for Tony by name. And this is, I think, from the preview montage. Should we put the deal off? And Ciro Lucas says, easier to put him off.
Yeah.
Our other guy, I think it's Frank, comes in. He ran the car, and the car registration does not match. It is not a Mr. Jameson. It is someone named Rockford. And his address, 29 Cove Road, Malibu. And Murray, Malibu. Well, at least the guy's got some class.
Yes. I wrote that line down too. I love the characterization of Murray throughout this whole thing. Mm-hmm. Like, Murray is in deep with something dangerous, playing two sides against each other, and his primary concern is just how people measure up to his aesthetic standard of owning rich things and living in rich, you know, like he's some facet of Angel that doesn't show up in Angel, right? Like I don't know, there's just something about it that I really, really like.
Yeah, he has, his aura is like the guy who once he achieved a certain standard made it his whole personality.
Yes, exactly. And we're gonna get such good insight into that later on too. This episode delivers on Murray.
And so I think that's what I was saying, like the Chasian shadow. I feel like Murray is a very Chasian character. He has this, again, kind of neurotic personality facet. It's not necessarily a flaw, but it is like something that shapes his worldview in a way that distorts reality.
So to psychoanalyze him for just a moment here.
As we should. I mean, what are we doing here?
We're going to find out a little bit later that there's probably some self-loathing going on.
Yeah.
And this is his way of elevating himself so he doesn't examine that, so he doesn't experience it. I'll bring it up when it comes up. We'll get to it when we get to it.
So we go to seeing Murray. So Murray has a very flashy red car is not in our files, so I'm not sure what kind of car it is.
Apparently it changes in the episode,
but it's flashy and red. That is the important thing. So he's in his car overlooking the beach, watching with binoculars as we see the goons sedan in the foreground, and then we cut into Jim's trailer, and they're searching the trailer. We do have a "come on, Jim" moment. Yeah. I mean, we always know him coming back to the trailer in the middle of the episode or the beginning of the episode is dangerous. But there was something about how the camera showed us the car where I was like, the car's right there. Like, Jim drives up and it's like, you didn't notice this car that's clearly a goon car, like, in front of your trailer? but maybe he's thinking about something else. Who knows? He does not have a bag of groceries, so it's not the full iconic moment. But we do have a very specific shot of the setup of our two goons hiding on the side of the door with one of them holding something heavy, waiting for the door to open so that he can indeed bring it down on the back of Jim's head. On the way down, he grabs Fred's pocket and it tears. So at first I'm like, oh, they mentioned the pills, so we can have this scene where he tears the pocket and all his pill bottles fall out and the goons scramble around to pick them up before they make their escape.
Yeah.
But I'm just realizing now that if he had followed Murray's advice and not put his pills in his jacket pocket,
yes,
this never would have happened.
That's why you need good, clean lines, especially when you're waylaying a private eye.
Jim recovers, evidently, as our next scene is he's on the phone talking to his client. He knows he was hit by guys from the health club because his locker was searched thoroughly and professionally. He doesn't know who else would be searching his trailer. He does have one lead. We see that he's holding one pill bottle and it has the name Fred Mullen on it. That lets Jim know that he's onto something, but obviously he's been made. He can't go back to the club. And we get another thing like, you know how much money I spent on that membership? But Jim is going to try an end run and he'll let him know what happens. Then we see that outside, Murray is still watching. So I think this is obviously we already had the like Murray's talking to two different groups.
Right.
This sequence definitely shows that he has some interest that's not exactly aligned with the goons.
Yes.
Because he's watching the whole thing play out. He's not just like he's not spotting for them. He's, you know, he's still there on his own.
And that is, I think, important to this story just because it's unclear in the beginning Murray's relationship with the goons, and it would be very easy given the fact that they listen raptly to him and he's better dressed than them that you have this, like, his first scene with them makes it feel a little bit like he's the boss.
Yeah
But he's not. This scene helps reinforce that. Obviously Ciro is the boss.
Jim has called in his good friend Dennis Becker to run. Well, he has a complaint as he was assaulted. So he gave Becker the name Fred Mullen to run. It didn't come back with anything. No warrants, no arrests. Jim is slightly incredulous. I think he says he didn't hit like a guy with no warrants or something like that.
Yeah.
And Becker says it's a computer, not a crystal ball. So they're at the station. The business here includes Jim asking for some aspirin, and then he asks for some water, and Becker like points at the water dispenser, the water dispenser.
Water cooler.
The cooler, yes, the water cooler. And it has the, I think we've been, every so often these come up, I don't know why it's so charming to me, but
the cones, yeah.
But the little flat cone that you pop into the triangle to pour the water in. Oh, it's so good. Jim decides not to file the report, and Dennis is not happy about it. So this conversation moves outside. Dennis doesn't like being used for information. Jim says that we're friends. Off duty, we're friends. On duty, I'm a cop.
Dennis, if I had a computer of my own, I'd run Fred Mullen through it in the peace and quiet of my own home. Hey, come on, pal. I'll buy you a cup of coffee.
I don't think I could afford it.
Outside, we see that Murray is watching them from across the street. He's on a payphone, and he's talking to one of the feds, who's reassuring him that there are no cops involved. You sure there's no cops involved? I guarantee it. And so as we see him watch Jim talk to Becker on the doorstep of the police station.
Yes.
Oh, that makes me feel real good.
I do like how inconspicuous Murray's car is.
Yeah, it is in an alley, so I guess it's not right there. But yeah, as soon as he pulls out, it's like you're never following anybody circumspectly.
There are shades of red, and this is definitely like the most alarming shade of red.
This is midlife crisis red.
Yeah.
We go to a park where Becker is taking a break to play, I'm guessing, handball?
Yeah, I'm guessing probably pickleball, right? I don't know sports.
It's a game where he wears some special white gloves and bounces a ball off of a concrete wall back to himself. So it's kind of like squash, but it's with, he doesn't have hands. A paddle, and obviously something he's not, there's not another person.
Yeah.
For some reason, I think this is handball. I don't actually know. I can remember at my elementary school that we had a wall like this, where it's just like a concrete wall with like a line in the middle.
Yeah. I would see them in New York. I'd never see anyone using them, but I'd see them.
Yeah, I imagine there's a couple different games you can play or sports or whatever. But yeah, it was just funny that I was like, oh, I remember that wall. Anyway. What's important here is that Murray has followed him there. Murray makes a costume change because, you know, as he knows, it's all about how you look.
Yes.
So he takes off his coat or changes his coat into a different coat. He changes his glasses and he takes off all of his rings and stuff.
He made a whole deal about cops and their accessories. Right. And I think he's like, I'm going
to. He has to de-accessorize because he's gonna try to run a little con on our friend Becker here. He takes a seat on the bench, so he has dressed down here. So he's a little more of a working Joe kind of look to him. Becker's like, "Hey, I have the court till 5:00." He's like, "Oh, I'm just watching. I pulled a muscle. I can't play anyway." And he has some banter about, "I've already gained 7 pounds not being on the court," something like that. He introduces himself and gets Becker's name, so he gets the good cold read.
Can I just say, I've never played handball. I don't, you know, or whatever this is. But if I were playing some sport like this, that is just me by myself outdoors, and someone came and sat on a bench and said, "Oh, I just want to watch,"
your alarm bells would be ringing.
Yeah, like there's, I would be like, "Oh, it's actually that's my time. I got to get going." Like that's. But anyways, Dennis is a little bit Dennis is a little more confident than I am. That's all I'm saying.
Well, once he gets Dennis's name, he's like, "Oh, fire department, right?" He's like, "No, LAPD." He is portraying himself as someone who has trouble remembering things, but gets there in the end.
Yes.
So that he can, he even mentions like, "You pay $600 for a memory course, and this is what happens."
Yes.
He says that he ran into a friend of Becker's in Malibu, was fishing with them off the pier, which is a good call.
Yes.
He's another cop. He's a cop that works with you. Oh, he says something. I'm sorry, police officer.
Yes. I've been called worse thing. I had completely forgot that was, because when I was brought up, I was told that you don't call police officers cops. And that's weird.
I imagine that the very, very popular show Cops probably did a lot to.
Well, before that, even probably Cop Rock did a lot of. You don't remember Cop Rock?
I don't remember.
You don't remember the police procedural that's also a musical that they tried to do? Okay, well, that's something to look up on your own, because that existed for a couple episodes at least.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy. Was that something where it was like a pretty well, like it was a pretty big name, like creator, like?
Yeah, I think it was meant to be a big thing. Now I'm looking it up because I'm sorry I brought it up. 1990.
I feel like it came up in some other podcast I listened to at some point.
Cop Rock, the complete series. Let's see here. Creators. Yeah, Stephen. How do you pronounce his last name? B-O-C-H-C-O.
Oh, Bochco?
Bochco, yeah. Oh, so yeah, okay. NYPD Blue and Hill Street Blues and LA Law. And he was like, "Let's do a police procedural that's a musical."
He was like, "I want to do this thing." And the studio's like, "Sure, whatever you want. You're one of the, you know, one of the most popular, you make the most popular shows on TV." And then he made just an atrocious, apparently what he really wanted to make was really bad.
Episode 4 is called A Three Corpse Meal. Corpse Meal. Episode 7 is called Copophiliac.
Is this a did it never air? Did they make it and then like the pilot was so bad it didn't air or something like that?
That might be the case. There's only 11 episodes
Oh no, it was canceled. It was canceled after 11 episodes. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Welcome to 11 a day. The 90s musical, police musical, cop rock. Huh. 11 a season. 11 a run. 11 a whole show.
All right. So it's worth looking up cop rock on Wikipedia.
Yeah, it's a deep dive. Why did I bring up cop rock? Oh, because we were talking about how cop used to be considered a slang term.
Back to our favorite cop. Becker asks, oh, what was his name? And he goes through this fumbling and goes, oh, no, I do remember. Rockford. I remember because it's a good, strong name for a cop. Which I think is funny just because we recently had Angel saying that Rockford is a good, strong name.
Yes.
It said he was working on a big case. And, you know, I'm a big fan of what you guys do down there.
Mm-hmm.
And Becker clearly is, you know, his alarm bell's ringing. And he excuses himself to make a phone call. And we see go to Jim's trailer where his phone is ringing. And we see he is not home.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, I have seen this episode. So I was pretty sure I knew which way this would break. But
yeah,
the question here is Becker's reaction, huh, this guy is trying to hustle me. I should find out why. Mm-hmm. Or is it, huh, Jim's impersonating a cop. I should find out why.
That is literally my notes. I was like, wait, is Dennis onto this or is he angry at Jim?
Right. I happen to remember which one it was, but I do think this is a good moment where you get to like kind of wait in suspense to see which way he's is going to land.
One of my favorite bits about this scene is how the conversation reaches a point where Dennis just says, I have to go make a phone call. Everyone in that conversation knows that he's going to like find out.
Yeah.
Like it's not like Dennis is hiding from Murray that the phone call is about something Murray just asked him, or is trying to like, he's just like, no, I'm done. I'm done with this. Whatever this is, I'm done.
We go to Jim staking out Fred Mullen's address. He takes a final bite of some kind of sandwich or donut or something. As he finally sees the man come out of his building.
The soundtrack here is, oh man, how to describe it? The conductor just points to a different instrument. And we just get like that instrument noodling for a little bit. And then he points to another one. It's great. Building to the theme.
And then we have a little sequence where we watch Jim follow Fred to the Beverly Sherwin Hotel, where we get some voiceover of Mr. Lucas wanted Fred to pick up Murray. Murray's been staying at this hotel. There's something like, oh, he doesn't think I know LA. He's like, oh, he just wants to make sure that you're safe and that I'm driving you. Jim watches this pickup happen. And then we go to a night scene where Jim is still watching them as they get out of this car and go into a barn out somewhere, obviously off the beaten path. It's not like this is a complicated scheme or anything. This episode does use voiceover liberally to make sure that we are tracking what's going on.
And which is somewhat needed in this. The episode is a nice, delightful romp, but there are, especially through the character of Murray, several twists happening that you don't want to be confused about things that aren't that.
The backbeat of the episode is this plot, which is this health club is a very good front for your gun running operation.
Yes.
Okay, cool. Now we know what's going on. But then all the fun stuff is on top of that. We go into the barn where Ciro, Angie, the other goon, and another miscellaneous goon has a rack of guns waiting to display to our buyer, Murray. So now we're getting that relationship. If Murray likes what he sees, he can get him as much as he wants. Jim sneaks in through like a back door to eavesdrop and, of course, ends up in a little alcove where they are going to start testing these automatic rifles. So we have kind of a gag where Murray wants a demonstration. Angie takes a gun and starts setting, you know, loading it and everything. Jim realizes that the only place for him to shoot this gun is where he is and takes cover. And then there's a couple rounds, no pun intended, where there's a demonstration and then Murray wants to try it. And so we just have a lot of Jim with his hands over his ears, crouching underneath shelving, hoping nobody shoots him by accident.
There's like shrapnel raining down on him. It's good. It's good comedy.
Yeah, it is. It is filmed comedically. It is not. At no time do I think Jim's in danger.
Yeah. Yeah.
He has this like little like receipt size accordion folder full of cash that he hands over, that Murray hands over for these guns. Jim slips out and then follows Murray to a big house with this empty garage where he and Fred, I might have been saying Frank earlier by accident. Doesn't really matter. Just in case I've changed this goon's name midstream.
Well, it's Fred Mullen played by Ben Frank. So you did all
either
right.
Either way. Okay. All right. Yeah, I knew that. But we see Jim, see them pull four big crates of guns out of this, the cavernous trunk of this car, and deposit them in this garage. And Jim clearly is noting, writes down the address.
Lots of skulking in this episode. I'm loving that.
There's a moment, I didn't screenshot it, but there's a moment where Jim's watching this from like crouched underneath a hedge. And the way it's lit is it's very green, like maybe it's a fake plant or something, but it's super, super green. And it just looked like the first frame of the Homer fades into the bushes.
Right.
To me, like Jim's kind of crouching there, like he's about to fade back into it. It's very funny.
Where they pull up to the house to unload, it's obviously a suburb, but it's like a suburb at night lit by these street lamps that just has that nostalgic feel for me of like this is like a Twilight Zone episode would start here, or you know, like there's just something about this particular scene. But the thing I wanted to say about the when we started the before we started recording, I think I mentioned that this episode is a transcriber's dream, and it just is. Like there's just lots of good stuff happening that doesn't require dialogue, and so there isn't, and there's nothing you have to write down, but as a transcriber you still get paid for being there and listening to it.
It's a, you know, it's a good, like, showcase for, like, the directing is important in this one.
Yes.
Because there's a lot of, like, what the camera sees and how the camera moves gives us information about, like, the relative importance of things, the sequence of events, all that stuff.
Oh, and then the wonderful dramatic irony, because we've seen the opening montage. Mm-hmm. So we see them put it in this garage, and you're just like, yeah, I know what happens next. I just want to see it play out.
It's time for us to take our traditional intermission, as we all need a little break to head out to the lobby, take a little stretch, get a snack, a drink, reflect on what's come before, and anticipate what's to come in this episode of The Rockford Files. We also like to take this time to remind you of where else you can find us on the internet. Epi, where can our listeners find you?
Well, you can find me at my website, dig1000holes.com. That's 1000 the number. Or you can find me as Epidiah on the Mastodon instance dice.camp or on co-host. Where can our listeners find you, Nathan?
All of my games, zines, podcast projects, and other work are at ndpdesign.com. You can also find me at NDP on co-host and over on Instagram at ndpdesign.games. And of course, you can always find this show, 200 a day, at 200aday.fireside.fm.
And now we return to the continuing adventures of Jimmy Rocco.
That playing out begins with Jim dragging Becker down to the station early. He has big news for him. Dennis is already simmering. And now, like, oh, okay, he's mad. He thinks Jim was impersonating a cop. Like, that comes together very obviously just in his face.
I tried to call you yesterday afternoon.
I wasn't home. I was up all night.
Yeah, I know. It must be rough being one of L.A.'s finest.
What's that supposed to mean?
It means there's a line, pal, and you cross it. Now, you work your mouth pretty good, but you're not going to talk your way out of this.
I do love that this whole thread of Jim being mistaken for a cop flies over Jim's head.
Yeah.
Every single time. Like, even way back in the beginning when we're in the health club and this guy's we're talking about, like, do you think Jim can hear him describing him? And it's clear that he doesn't, because not in that moment, but like, but that's the joke, right?
Yeah, yeah.
This whole confusion about him pretending or being a cop doesn't land home, till even later than this. Like, yeah. It just, he's like, what's going on?
Jim wants Dennis to shut up and listen to him. And Dennis, no, you shut up and listen to me for a change. And Jim is like, fine, I should have gone to ATF in the first place. Alcohol, tobacco, and firearms? Jim had something for Dennis that could help him make lieutenant, but he'll go make someone else a hero.
Gun running? If there was an operation like that, I would have heard about it.
You're hearing about it now. I was in on a sales demonstration. I saw the buy go down. I know where they stash the guns. I can even name a few names for you and tell you where to find them. You want to stand around talking? You want to move on in it?
Pull up a chair, Jimbo, old buddy. Sit down, we'll talk about it.
It's good stuff.
So yeah, conveniently passed over is the mention of Jim being one of LA's finest, as you say. We cut from here to a full SWAT sting.
Oh, Dennis.
It's like the full thing. There is a bit where it's like, where Jim's like, is this all necessary? Yeah, this is a bit much. We're dealing with automatic weapons. They were in crates. They weren't wearing them. But yeah, there's a lot of logistics involved to sweep this place. So we have a long sequence again with very little dialogue of just watching this SWAT team, which again, in two modern eyes, just looks like these are just what cops look like now. Like,
yeah, yeah.
Like the level of armament is just what the guys on Segways downtown Chicago have, like all of these weapons now. Like it's wild just how much like militarization has happened.
Yeah.
But anyway, they sweep the house. It's empty.
Quick shout out to whoever is the Foley artist for running sounds, because this scene is just full of wonderful like boots on sidewalk sounds throughout it as these SWAT team members attempt to breach.
Mm-hmm. They open the garage and it is empty. I think Des is at first like, if this is the wrong house, and he's like, no, I saw them on this bench.
Yes. I think
from the preview montage. It must have been a way station. We should have gotten here earlier. Dennis loses his cool, yells at Jim, including for impersonating a police officer. Mm-hmm. And Jim has a confused look. There are two good Billings moments in this episode. Our first Billings moment is he just kind of like fades into the background while Dennis is yelling and then goes, where are the guns, Sarge?
What do we do now?
Then how do I explain this? How the hell do I explain this? And we cut, joke in the cut to Chapman. There is no explanation, no possible rational explanation.
So good.
I feel like this is the kind of scene we usually get at the beginning of a Chapman episode. And
yeah,
it's not really a Chapman episode, so we just get it here. But, you know, Chapman is incensed. He's going to have a citizens committee on his head in a minute. He doesn't even know what the manpower allocations are yet. And he's going to make Rockford pay for the property damages. Jim tries to cover for Becker, not cover, but like explain, like, I made a complaint and Becker followed up on it. This is pure procedure.
I think he literally says this is on me.
Yeah.
Like trying to take the heat off of Becker. And Becker, I don't think it's even really out of loyalty for Rockford. It's just, he's like, no, I take full responsibility.
Right.
Because he's just trying to calm Chapman down. Right. Like it's, yeah, yeah.
He's also like, you know, kind of appeal to I don't know. Appeal to his department structure. He's like, I received a very detailed report from Rockford.
Right, yes.
It had names, it had specific descriptions, and so I made the call. And he's like, who are you to make the call? Well, the duty captain or the watch commander or something agreed with me. He's like, well, the watch commander doesn't know Rockford. Chapman just keeps finding these little like ways to make it personal and thus improper what Becker did, though. When you hear Becker spell it out, it's like, yeah, the whole SWAT thing does seem like a lot, but
yeah,
he couldn't have not done anything, right? Based on this kind of report. Well, Chapman is going to bust Jim for this as hard as he can, starts listing charges.
I don't even know where to start with the charges against you. There's filing a phony police report, and then there's
impersonating an officer, Sergeant Becker.
Becker frantically waves him off from behind.
Hey, Lieutenant, wait a minute.
Yes, so good.
Chapman kind of doesn't really respond to that, which is probably for the best.
Yeah, I mean, Chapman's all worked up about everything anyways. He's not catching too much blood in his ears.
Yeah, right. Rockford has facts. He names the buyer and the sellers. He names Ciro Lucas and Chapman. Ciro Lucas is a known racketeer. That's a nice, safe name for you to drop.
Yes, so good.
As opposed to, is a known racketeer. Thus, it makes sense that he could be involved with a gun-running situation. But he tells Billings to book him. Chapman and Becker haven't seen any guns because there aren't any guns. And then we have the classic Becker kind of sighs and puts his hand out. And Jim unclips his visitor badge, puts it in Becker's hand.
One thing I like about Chapman, he often thinks he's got Rockford figured out, like, entirely. I love just those moments where he's like, oh, because you're doing, like, some read on Rockford that makes everything he's done make sense, but in a way that's nefarious, you know? Like, it's good.
But, like, there's never any, like, why would Jim be going to all this effort and stuff? It's like, oh, well, just to annoy me personally, obviously.
Yeah.
Well, we haven't seen any guns because there aren't any guns. And we go for, it's not really joking the cut, but we go from that line to Murray and the feds examining the guns that Murray bought. They want all the guns Murray can get. He says, no problem. So it is now clear that these are federal officers. They Murray is doing a sting. He's buying the guns. They have a line where it's like, once we have all of the guns, then we can bust the ring. Murray's in a full plaid suit with the big tie in this particular scene, which is pretty amazing. There's a good bit here where Murray has another piece of info for them just on the side. But he knows that Ciro Lucas is bribing a federal judge. He doesn't have the name yet, but he can find out. And when the Fed says, oh, we already know about that. Murray says, how do you know? It was Rockford, right? And we see that he has now constructed this whole elaborate situation in his head where he doesn't like being double booked on these things. He's worked for feds in like New York, Chicago, like, you know, all these cities. And I've never been double booked. They say, we don't know anyone named Rockford. Murray doesn't like getting stiffed. And he leaves on, you tell Rockford to stay out of my way. He leaves. Who's Rockford? I don't know. He's paranoid. And then the other fed, we didn't know anything about Ciro bribing a judge. Well, we do now. And it didn't cost us a cent.
That's good.
We don't have the name, but we do know how to get it.
Yeah. I don't know. I just really like the alternate universe that Murray is living in. Because basically this story is just Murray misunderstanding Rockford's presence in his life. And everything Murray does about that is just propelling it forwards towards the end, right?
And it's like, his willful disregard for believing what people say.
Right, yes.
Like, everyone is very clear to him, and he's like, no, you're lying to me.
Yeah, exactly.
There's an element, I think we talked about this in the movie we recently did, but there's an element of, like, screwball comedy to his story, where he just, like, takes all these misunderstandings and spins them into a situation that itself will create more misunderstandings.
Yes.
But on We Do Know How to Get It, we cut to Jim's trailer, where we learn that Rocky bailed him out. Good old Rocky. But he'll get the money back to him somehow. Rocky wants to know what's going on. He thought it was just this insurance gig. Jim has a theory. Mm-hmm. What if Tom Varney's fall wasn't an accident? What if he ran across the gun running operation? I'm going to go check out the club. And on that, he takes his gun out of the cookie jar. Rocky doesn't like it. There won't be any guns at the club, Rocky. There's going to be the gun you just put in your pocket.
Rocky's so good in this episode.
Mm-hmm.
And this is it. This is his only scene, right? Like, this is...
He's in the last scene, but yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I love after Jim leaves, he just mutters to himself,
smart alley kid.
Yeah, my note here is, shot for shot, some of the best Rocky material. It's not a lot of Rocky, but, like, it's just good. It's just good. I do like that, like, he's like, Rocky's like, well, you ought to quit. And Jim's like, I can't. Chapman's trying to stick me with the bill for the house. Like, I got to keep going. I need to make this money to pay off the damages that I've already done.
Or I need to make it so that I'm not on the hook for them.
Yeah, yeah.
At the club, Jim picks the lock, pokes around, and then comes upon a slow reveal of a desk phone that's disassembled with a little microphone, a bug sitting right next to it. And that's when the slightly, I'm not going to say sleazier, but maybe the more underhanded.
Yeah, the more worldly Fed.
Well, we know it now, and it didn't cost us a cent. That guy. That's when he stands up out of the shadow-covered armchair, holding the gun on Jim. And Jim just goes, hi.
I like that Jim has kind of clocked what's happening in this almost right away. Like, he at least knows he's up with a Fed and not a thug.
Right, right. Now we have the formal establishing shot of the federal building sign, where our two guys want some answers. Jim doesn't have anything to say. They apparently locked him up overnight. They thought maybe the chilling out would change his mind or whatever. Well, they caught him red-handed, breaking and entering. First of all, good gag was like, I didn't break anything. I used lockpicks. And then when I entered, it was to catch your guy red-handed planting a bug. And he says, I was there in an official capacity. Like, well, I didn't know the feds spend money on black bag operations or something. Mm-hmm. Unless you had a court order, and there's just a significant pause. Well, in that case, I'll be going. They try to shake him down, and he goes, look, pal, we're both caught dirty. That means this is a standoff. You can't charge me without implicating your friend here. They're like, all right, well, they introduce themselves. They're like, okay, fine, but like, you know, I'm this officer, whoever, and you are. And he's like, Jim Rockford. Rockford? The cop? The cop? Where did you get that? So prior to this, there is a, I think it was in the yelling in the empty garage where Becker says, you're impersonating a cop, your buddy or your friend, I think Harry Pate was like the alias that Murray gave. Yeah. Your friend Harry Pate told me. So that was, you know, earlier. So here, the cop, where did you get that? Harry Pate? Who's that? Damned if I know.
Yeah. I love the confusion going on here. This is, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then outside, we see that Murray is lurking in the hall, sees Jim leave their office. And so that is going to pour fuel on his paranoid fire.
Yeah.
Inside, they have a great conversation with Chapman. They're calling him to ask if Rockford is a cop.
Right.
And he just keys in on all the, like, the vestigial things. Like, you've been talking to Rockford?
You must have a pretty low opinion of this department.
Then he isn't a member of LAPD?
Is that what he claimed?
Did he try to pass himself off as a police officer to you?
No, not exactly. Look, Lieutenant, you seem to know Rockford. If he has no connection with the department, then...
None whatsoever. Except some frequent visits to the booking desk.
Yes. Oh, so good.
It's really funny. But they do finally establish that he is not one of LA's finest. And then they hang up. If he's not a cop, well, then who is he? There's just a big shrug. We now get the Murray character scene where we meet Murray at home talking to his, his wife.
Oh, I love this scene. Lillian.
8 months on the job, then find out they're running a game on me. And she's like, you don't know that. So there's great banter here. He's laying out his paranoid theory. And she, I think, with the air of, I know how you think.
Right.
You know, is like bringing him down. Like, you don't know that. Why would they do that to you? They have no ethics, none whatsoever. It's not like I'm making a fortune. Mm-hmm. I'm doing peace work. There's a title of our episode.
Yes.
Well, why don't you just talk to him? No, that's not going to work. Like, that's not going to do anything. No more talking. The government spends $10 million a year on his kind of work. All he wants is his share. This is when their son comes home. The character's name is just Junior Rosner, which is kind of funny.
This whole household is a very almost Leave It to Beaver kind of, like, it's great that this is just like a normal family. It's not like nothing is, what's the word I'm looking for? This is just suburbia. There's no overt wealth or opulence or any, like, because he's the guy who likes to dress well. That's part of his whole deal. And the family is just so normal.
Well, and I think we get that it's one reason we get that feeling where it's like he's, it's not like he's always come from money or whatever. Like this right. is the yeah. this is the
it's
guy
social
who,
climbing thing.
Yeah, who hit a certain yeah. level and is ambitious to reach the next level.
Yeah.
But why is her son home from school? Lillian's just like, don't worry about it. He's fine. Everything's fine. Don't worry about it. Like, what do you mean don't worry about it? Like yeah. so we get a little sense of that dynamic there. No one tells me anything. But apparently he caught another kid smoking behind the school, and he would have made a citizen's arrest, but he didn't know how.
You finked?
Murray.
Do you know what that makes you? You're an informer.
Utter oblivion, like obliviousness, like he, just no self-awareness, none whatsoever.
Look, I'm doing work that I'm getting paid for. That's different mm-hmm. from being an informer.
Yeah. yeah.
Uh-huh. He can't handle this. He's leaving to take care of the competition. Nobody's getting hurt. I'm just taking Rockford out for the final quarter until I collect what's due.
Yeah.
So we get to our car chase.
Mm-hmm.
As our chief car chase correspondent, how well, does this one go down?
I want to start by, again, the soundtrack is great. This one, so the whole point of this car chase, he's following Jim, and we get this great like moment where Jim knows he's being followed, because why wouldn't you with right. a car that red in your...
Yeah, we don't even have to see like shot... return shot, like we just kind of yeah. see him looking in his rear view. We're like, oh yeah, he saw the car.
And then we see that Jim puts on the brakes, and this guy comes to a full stop in the middle of the street behind him, and then Jim pulls a Huey and he follows. So like it, all the subtlety's gone now. Nobody's pretending to be anything that they're not. And at this point then, with the subtlety gone, like what's Murray gonna do? Mm-hmm. He's gonna have to run Jim off the road, right? Like that's the
Mm-hmm.
So we get a lot of good muscle car, like one, Murray trying to overtake Jim on this.
Just kind of like an access road or.
Yeah, like we see these roads all the time.
Two lane highway yeah. or something. There's music in the soundtrack through the up until Jim makes the hard turn, and then it drops yeah. and we get just all the diegetic car noises.
This is dangerous now, right? Like we're having fun, but now we're in danger. And he tries to overtake him, and then Jim gets him on the other side and runs him into a closed road or something like that. I'm trying to remember how he does that.
Like the whole story here is basically just that Jim is just faster. Like he's just yeah. able to stay ahead of Murray just by a nose, kind of no matter what. So there's a moment I think where Murray drops behind to try and like. Go on his other side, and he takes right. that opportunity to swerve, and that pushes Murray off there's like a wooden gate that he crashes through.
Yeah, it's like an exit that might be a private access or something like that.
It's in the preview montage.
Yeah, it's yeah. yeah. And then we learn an important lesson about seatbelts mm-hmm. because he's slumped over his steering wheel, the horn honking, and that's it for him. He's out like a light.
Seatbelts and the addition of airbags into
yes.
cars clearly happened after this, because it's that would have saved him from a nasty concussion.
Mm-hmm.
We do end on a line of Murray asking what happened, and he's all woozy. You tried to take me out, Murray. Now let's talk about why. And then he just slumps forward.
This is unfortunate for Murray, but it's also, as it turns out, unfortunate for Jim, which I love, because. We go straight to the hospital, right? That's where we're at. And now Chapman's there and the feds are there
mm-hmm.
and Dennis is there, I believe. Yes. yes. And everyone is angry at Rockford for having not been run off the road, I guess.
Rockford says something like, he tried to run me off the road. Why? Yeah. You know, and he's like, well, the State Patrol can confirm that. They looked at the skid marks. Like,
yes.
but Murray has a severe concussion. He's only responding to his name, to Rockford's name, and occasionally muttering that his son is a fink. The three big things on his mind. The feds know that the big gun buy is supposed to be today, but they don't know where. And they go out in the hall to talk, and there's the business about, you know, Jim being in trouble, and what was he supposed to do? He's getting run off the road, etc. One of the feds stayed in with him and comes out and says, he just said 3:00. What does that mean? I don't know. 3:00. 8 months of work down the drain. The feds go back in. He shouldn't be alone in case he says something else. Chapman says that Jim and Rockford have a lot to answer for before he storms off. And then Becker informs Jim that part of that is that Chapman's even talking about pulling his license.
Oh, yeah.
But Jim thinks they can bust this by. They know it's today. They know it's at 3 o'clock.
Mm-hmm. They just don't know where.
But they have Fred Mullen.
Mm-hmm.
So Jim and Becker in presumably a department car, mm-hmm. not the Firebird, are staking out Fred's place again. His car's there. He's at home. And there's a moving truck on the street. Maybe that's for transporting the guns.
Mm-hmm.
How do we know it's at 3 o'clock? We're just going to assume that because that's what Murray muttered in his sleep. And,
yeah.
and it's a TV show. So, you know, when he doesn't show, they'll get nervous and they'll move the guns to another location just in case. And then sure enough, Fred comes out, gets into the truck, and we follow him to whatever is happening. We have a brief scene where he goes to the motel where he's supposed to pick up Murray. He's calling Lucas to say that Murray isn't there. So we're establishing, yes, this is indeed what Jim thought would happen is what's happening. Dennis and Jim continue to follow the truck. And then we cut to a perspective shot where we see guys loading a bunch of crates out of this, like, you know, the trunk of this giant trunk of the Oldsmobile or whatever, into the moving truck. And then we zoom back and see that is from the perspective of Jim and Dennis. They're at like a lumber yard and they're looking through this gap in like a stack of lumber. Chapman has had plenty of time to get there, but Dennis says he wasn't happy when I radioed in and he had to say that he saw the guns. And then he looks at Jim.
Right.
There better be guns. We hear the sirens as they finish loading the truck. Our goons scatter, but it is to no avail. They are already surrounded. Mm-hmm. The only wrinkle here is that Fred guns the truck directly towards the lumber pile that Jim and Dennis are hiding behind. So they have to dive for cover, but it is a big enough pile that it stops the truck.
I love that they just drove a truck into a pile of lumber. Like, that's satisfying.
Yeah. And so Jim and Dennis are able to put the handcuffs on Fred, and with a bit of a dig here, Fred, now you really have something to be depressed about, right? Because he's on all the medication.
Yeah, we can assume it's
waka waka.
Antidepressants or something.
Our last scene here, Jim, Becker, and Rocky having a celebratory drink at the sandcastle.
I love this scene.
This is one of the best outcome episodes that I can remember.
Yes, there's several things I love about this. One, the episode ends with these three being really chummy, which is great because the whole episode is nothing but tension between all three of them. And like that is, we've talked about this from time to time, but like if you have an ongoing show and you have a couple of friends like Jim and Angel or Jim and Dennis, and you're like, we're going to make a lot of hay out of the tension between them in their relationship, then you may end up with viewers who at some point, it's usually more obvious if you binge them rather than have to come back each week, but nonetheless are going to be like, why are they even friends? Mm-hmm. So you have to show them being friends here. This is one of those scenes where, also Rocky's involved and Rocky's proud of Jim and thinks Jim should be like getting more credit than he's getting. And Dennis is like, yeah. And then Jim's like, ah, but Dennis, you know, like it's good. It's very good stuff. Even before Murray shows up. We learned during this that Jim gets paid by the feds $5,000 at the end. So that's, you know, by our metric, that's like $25,000.
Right. Roughly.
Modern money, you know.
One imagines that will pay Rocky back for bail.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, and Becker not only gets a commendation, he also got a promotion to Investigator 3.
Yes.
And the pay bump that comes with it.
Yeah, very good outcome for both of them.
Mm-hmm.
Murray shows up with a Band-Aid on his head, I think, to indicate that he had the concussion.
Well, I will say the other benefit for Jim is that Chapman dropped the charges.
Oh, right. Yes. Yes.
Because Rocky wants him to get a certificate of merit or something. And Jim's like, well, that's all I wanted. And he made it okay himself with the government paid for his help. And then we learn through talking to Murray. Well, before Murray shows up, we get the little conclusion to, you know, the mystery that really was that we were really concerned with, which is what happened to the guy who got paralyzed.
Right. Yes.
Because it turns out the insurance company's in the clear. That guy was fooling around with another guy's girlfriend. Mm-hmm. And the other guy who's Tony or whoever with the tan. But they actually the credit. I just saw that the.
Oh, yeah. He's uncredited.
The Palm Springs tan. And so the credit on IMDb is Palm Springs tan Tony, which is great. Anyway, so that guy threw him in the pool.
Yeah. Completely unrelated.
The insurance company's off the hook. One imagines that Jim maybe got paid by them because he did finish that case. And then Murray comes up. Yeah. He wants his money. He worked 8 months on that deal. He already ordered the sprinklers. When he was talking to his wife, he was like, you tell me you're tired of hauling the hose around. I'm going to get you sprinklers. I need to work. I need to make money. Mm-hmm. And then to Jim, you're not even a cop. Why do you think I was a cop? Cops dress lousy. So Dennis is here going like, not now, Murray. This isn't the place. Mm-hmm. But Jim's more like affable. He's like,
yeah,
I don't know what you want from me. I was not involved. but he invites him. He says, Murray, sit down. Have a drink on me. Pour some champagne.
Free booze on me.
Hey, how much you get for him?
$5,000.
$5,000. They're worth more than that. That ain't a fraction of what they're worth. You get paid per gun, dummy. How many were there? Didn't even count them, huh?
Well, it never occurred to me.
$5,000. You know something, Rockford? You got stiffed.
Yeah.
And Jim smiles and raises his glass in a toast. And I think he just says, yeah. That's the end of the episode.
It's good. I love it. I love that he just can't straight up win.
Mm-hmm.
But also, you know, tells something about Murray there where it also gives Murray like a little bit of a status thing there. Like, I would have made more money than you if I had been properly paid or whatever. It's a fun one.
And it does kind of give a little bit of credence to Murray's paranoia. Cause it's kind of like at the end of the day, he did a bunch of work. He was going to get paid per gun. And then he ended up not concluding the deal and not getting paid. And like, that sucks. That, he should have been paranoid about something like that happening, which is why you always get at least a part of it up front, Murray.
That one fed, the worldly fed, mm-hmm. was definitely angling to get. I mean, he's clearly the one who paid Rockford and said, oh, now I paid him.
My case to my superiors is we save a lot of money by paying Rockford and ditching Murray. And they're like, yeah, sure.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, definitely a fun one. Pretty breezy to talk about, but not some episodes are very kind of like you hop along and you do the thing and you're like, oh, that was fun. This one has the memorable character. For sure. Has Michael Lerner doing some good work.
And like the parallel realities of Kim mistaking Jim for a cop. So there's the reality where Jim's impersonating a cop. And like, I love that.
And he has kind of that mirror, like, I mean, I guess we put together that basically, like, this is his job. Like, he, like, does piecework, like, for feds. So that's not necessarily a private investigator, but, like, it's a similar set of skills. And so we kind of get the fun parallel of him, like, you know, trying to get info out of Dennis using the same techniques that we would see Jim use in a similar situation. So that's definitely fun. You kind of get that sense that like in different circumstances, this could be like one of the PI buddies in Jim's orbit or rival PIs in Jim's orbit, or potentially a returning, there could be another episode with this character Murray and that would, there's enough there to have some fun with that, but memorable in that way. And, love to see the evolution of Dennis's career.
Yes.
I think maybe one of the, so we can do the Patreon collections. I've been slowly putting them together, mostly the seasons, so that all the seasons are, you know, in one place if you wanted to go through them. But I have a couple other ones, and a fun one might be Becker's career and like,
right, you can follow where he gets promoted
and stuff, Because, you know, it would be 6 or 7 episodes, I think.
Yeah, he's not lieutenant until the movies, right?
He gets promoted to lieutenant in the next season, I think.
Oh, he does. Okay.
He's a lieutenant by the end of the show.
Yeah, the Rockford Files wiki doesn't tell us. Hold on. In the 5th season, Kill the Messenger. Okay, so this says specifically, at the time of his promotion, it was revealed that Becker's association with Rockford, who was considered by LAPD brass to be a shifty ex-con, has hampered Becker's chances for promotion. And that was in Kill the Messenger.
That's Kill the Messenger, yeah.
So, yeah, he must have got promoted then, or like between the episodes or something.
Right, because that's the episode where he actually has to investigate his, one of the police, like, chiefs who murdered their wife. Yeah. We'll figure it out.
The one before that is White on White and Nearly Perfect. And I don't remember that being a case there. Oh, I'm just looking at, Hardik's a Fool, Rosendahl and Guildenstern are dead, The Jersey Bounce, White on White, Nearly Perfect, then Kill the Messenger. It must be Kill the Messenger then.
I think,
yeah.
That sounds about right. I'll do a dive. I'll figure it out and I'll put that collection together because that's kind of a fun.
Yeah.
A fun bit. Oh, okay. Yeah, no, it's in Kill the Messenger, where he's promoted to lieutenant. Promoted to lieutenant. Because, so yeah, the write-up that was triggering my memory was for Profit and Loss, which I was looking at because Michael Lerner's in it. In that Robertson book, there's a paragraph that says, Rockford calls for the police and asks for Lieutenant Becker. Either this was an oversight, or Becker must have gotten into big trouble with the department, because by the time we see Dennis again in Sleight of Hand, he's a sergeant. Becker, of course, was promoted to lieutenant for good in the 5th season episode, Kill the Messenger.
Ah, there we go.
Well, now that we've gone down that digression. Anyway, so this gets to be a nice little speed. We get to see, this is Investigator 3, so maybe we'll see if there's another level before he makes sergeant, because he has to like do the application and all that stuff is like part of the story.
There are plenty more natural numbers.
Yes. Fun episode. I think a good, like, just throw on because you want to watch a Rockford episode.
It's a fun time. Great soundtrack. I really enjoyed what was going on in the soundtrack in this one. And, just a nice little romp.
So that's a thumbs up for Piecework, a good piece of work, if you ask me.
Well done.
And remember to always get at least a chunk of your money up first, just in case some random PI stumbles in and busts up your gig. But a lesson we can all take something from.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, unless you have anything else, I think that's about it for this one. But never fear. We will be back next time to talk about another episode of The Rockford Files.